very black type of pigment called Vanta Black. He is the sole agent for this tape. And apparently this annoyed artists a great deal. There was this one artist called Stuart Semple who's developed a number of unique paint pigments himself. He's had something he calls the pinkest pink. He has another that he calls the most glittery glitter. And he has something called Black 2.0. It only has an absorption of about 95% to 96%, whereas the Vanta Black is ridiculously 99.965%. Anyway, anyone, you and I, can buy this. The only person who can't buy these set of pigments is, of course, Anish Kapoor, who is the gentleman who started this whole fight. Despite that, on Instagram, Anish Kapoor actually took a picture of himself. He had dipped his middle finger into the pinkest pink pigment of the other guy and sent it off to the artist that wasn't allowing him to buy it. So just when you think that hams have arguments, artists have arguments as well, and people are still searching for the blackest black. So far, it's...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, didn't think I talked terribly that long, but I'll try and talk shorter. The next little story, mini story, is probably the most worthless gizmo that I've seen announced on the internet in some time, and given the internet, that's a lot. They're called Loomis candles. They light their own wick with a simple push of a button on their removable base. When placed on its special base, the Loomis candles auto-ignite their wick with real flame and burn for about 40 hours before needing to be replaced, according to their creator. The base is rechargeable, so it doesn't need to be tethered to an outlet, allowing you to place the candles wherever you want. The benefit, no more need for those ubiquitous safety matches, possibly the cheapest consumer item at this time. The downside, how much money do you have to burn? Scratch that. If you're willing to start your candles with a crisp dollar bill, you wouldn't need this gizmo, and you would end up saving money. For just $144, you can acquire six entire candles and a rechargeable base. And while the base is rechargeable, and can be used over and over again, the candles are extremely proprietary and can only be replaced by their manufacturers for a lot more money. So my guess is, when this business plan goes pear-shaped and collapses, they're probably going to use regular matches rather than their gizmo to burn down their place for insurance money. Let me drop for any comments or questions.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
How does it ignite? In other words, you push a button, a battery in there, and some kind of heating element near the wick. Is that what they're doing?
Well, they don't like to give away their secret, but my guess would be that there's some kind of induction going on, inductive powering. Although, theoretically, you could build a small powered device to ignite in the candlestick, and all you would need to wave a magnet over a sensor to do it. So the actual trick is kind of hidden, but the concept is that most of the energy is in the base. It couples up to some hidden device in the core of the candle and leads to it igniting into fire.
This sounds like a possible fire hazard. You can touch something or whatever, it's going to light all by itself. The dog jumps on it, the cat. Who knows? This sounds like a fire hazard.
Sounds like too many investment people with too much money to waste on too many stupid ideas. Up until now, probably the dumbest idea that I was aware of, there was this strange juicing company in which there were proprietary containers of pre-squeezed juice. You'd buy this ridiculous piece of equipment that was engineered like a tank. You'd put the little bag into it, push the magic button, and it would basically just squeeze the contents out so that you could drink the damn juice. Of course, it made no money, it folded, and people are now disassembling them on YouTube just out of curiosity.
I'm starting to believe the old saying that 95% of the businesses that start go out of business. Okay, very good, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much. And here's another little addendum. Last week, Paul asked me how many atoms were in a cell, and I said something along the way that they amount to billions and billions of them. I've kind of looked it up just to make sure of my facts, as I tend to do, and the going number that's usually listed for a human cell, the average, because there are small cells and big cells, but the average is about 100 trillion atoms in an average human cell. The number of molecules in a human cell are problematic because you have to realize that we also talked about DNA last week, and DNA, each little DNA molecule is enormous. Our 46 individual chromosomes add up to 204 billion atoms alone. So there's a lot of atoms in our body. But another little curious thing that I was wondering about is, anyone have any kind of guess of how many human cells your body contains? Now, come on. Someone must have a guess. We don't take points off or anything. How many, I mean, I'll give you a clue. It's certainly more than a billion cells in our body.
Wait, what's the question? The question is how many cells or how many atoms? What's the question? 100 billion cells.
Yeah, Paul, the question is how many cells in the human body approximately? Because it obviously depends upon your size, your age, and other conditions. So we're talking about a rough approximate, and we have one person who's suggesting, I think he said 400 billion?
100 billion.
100 billion is up there. Anyone want to go any higher?
After that last thing that you came up with, I'm going to go with a trillion. I'm going to go with a trillion cells.
Okay, smart move, Paul. We have a trillion. Anyone for more than a trillion? Going.
2 trillion.
Okay, now I get the feeling that I now know more about Banksy's auction house from this experience. No, in matter of fact, they used to say there was as much as 100 trillion human cells. They've downscaled that in the past few years, and the approximation that gets the most press is 30 trillion human cells in your body. And a lot of them are red blood cells because they're rather small, they take up less space, and we have a lot of them. So it's 30 trillion cells. So now, let me ask you another question in the same vein that might annoy the heck out of you. How many bacterial cells do you think we harbor on and in our body, given that we have 30 trillion human cells making us a human being?
I don't know. I read the total amount was in pounds of cells, so pounds of bacteria. WS2N is going to say 100 trillion, over three times the amount.
Okay, Paul, thanks. Anyone else with any estimations or guesstimations? Okay, as a matter of fact, the general understanding is that we harbor approximately 39 trillion bacterial cells. It's on the surface of our body and in our colon and all kinds of nooks and crannies. So thankfully, bacteria, although they're much smaller than human cells, thankfully they don't get a vote, because otherwise we'd all be outvoted by the bacteria. Okay, here's a little puzzle to ponder. There's something in the survival training called the rules of threes, that without air for longer than 3 minutes, or shelter from a harsh environment for more than 3 weeks, or water for 3 days, or food for 3 weeks, you'll undergo a biological version of an irreversible cascade failure that will lead to death. Numbers are a bit arbitrary and depend upon many factors: physical exertion, metabolic rate, local temperature, humidity, the amount of fat stores. The rules of three is a memorable approximation. But there is more to life than eating, drinking, and breathing, or so they tell me. Does anyone out there think that a person could possibly die from sheer lack of sleep?
Please checking, Roger, Roger.
SID, Roger, Roger.
Yeah, Roger. This is KC2, Queen, E, Whiskey. Oh. Plug in my home station here. This is Harrison, Yankee Whiskey. Back to you.
Okay, nice to hear that you're listening, Joe. So once again, I ask the audience, do you think it's possible to die from sheer lack of sleep? I'm sure we have many insomniacs out there who are interested in this question. I'm sure some people have some good ideas one way or the other. So what does the audience say? Do you think it's possible to die from sheer lack of sleep?
Yeah, Roger, Roger. It could happen. Back to you.
Okay. It actually is a published record of the longest continuous hours of being awake. It goes to a high school student, of all people, from 1965. The kid's name was Randy Gardner. He spent 264 hours awake. That's almost 11 straight days, and he did it for a science project and lived to tell the tale. It's difficult to get a research study into documenting how long experimentally caused sleep deprivation is needed to kill a human subject, for both moral and ethical reasons, as well as for the legal bills. We can do these macabre experiments on lab rats, but without too much worry about dealing with the rat's family or their lawyers. In these laboratory experiments, it took approximately 32 days of total sleep deprivation before all the lab rats were dead. Although researchers are not in agreement with what the actual cause of death was. Let me drop for a second. Now, some researchers thought it was the lab rat's loss of thermal regulation that led to a deadly drop in their body temperature, and other researchers thought that the rats became so immunocompromised that they died to otherwise innocuous infections, and still other researchers thought that the sleep loss caused irreparable brain damage. Still others thought it was just the general stress of this condition that killed all the lab rats. Unfortunately, although humanity's ethics preclude death by insomnia, Mother Nature can be far less kind. There's something called familial fatal insomnia. It is extremely rare, it usually runs in families, and it can become progressively worse until the victim dies of his insomnia. Let me drop for a second. It's probably more complicated than death simply by insomnia. The disease occurs by way of something called a prion. These are smaller than even viruses. The patients possess a mutation for a specific protein that causes them to bind to each other in a manner that the body can't remove. It collects over time, causing the brain further and further problems until it fails. It usually presents initially as insomnia, but as the condition progresses, people experience hallucinations, deliriums, and confusion, not unlike senility, and then finally death. There's no treatment, there's no cure. As Shakespeare had a great line, Macbeth doth kill sleep, but it's a strange thing to think that lack of sleep can kill Macbeth as well. Now, I'm going to put up on my link a couple of interesting a YouTube from a TED Talk on sleep and what it does to you and what happens if you don't have it. And there's an interesting little article that I just read recently about someone who stayed up for 24 hours and documented their greater and greater cognitive dysfunction. So those will be available as well. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX. A few months ago, if you recall, I spoke about a recent discovery that Native American dogs had died out with the invasion of the European branch of the family tree. That was caused by immigrants bringing their old world dogs with them to the New World. Well, all that remains of those long dead New World dogs, there are some of their genetic sequences that got included in the genetic code of a canine venereal infestation that's still alive to this day. Now, it would seem that those old world dogs had pulled the same trick in Europe earlier. They found out that the original dogs that European dogs now come from invaded and completely competed successfully against the original European line of canine and led to the dog's extinction as well. Apparently, starting around 11,000 years ago, the Neolithic farmers who had themselves in the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East, what's now known as Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and Iraq, began to migrate into Europe. As they settled into new lands, these pioneering farmers brought their domesticated animals with them, such as sheep, goats, pigs, cattle, and along with that, with cultivated plants like wheat, barley, peas, and lentils. Let me drop for a second. Less known, however, is whether these farmers brought their dogs as well, or if they simply adopted the indigenous population of European dogs who had been living on the continent for thousands of years prior to the Neolithic expansion. As new genetic evidence published this week in Biology Letters indicates, these original European dogs who lived with the Mesolithic hunter-gatherers gradually disappeared from the continent, replaced by the canines who arrived from the Fertile Crescent alongside their Neolithic. The close connection between human and dogs, this new research suggests, goes even farther back into time than we had thought. The researchers conducted a genetic analysis of nearly 100 canines remains uncovered at 37 archaeological sites throughout Europe, from the early Mesolithic to the Bronze Age. The researchers were seeking to link a specific mitochondrial canine haplogroup to Neolithic farmers and then determine if, where, and when this lineage made its way to Europe. Let me drop for a second. In genetics, a mitochondrial haplogroup can be used to identify and track a specific population that shares a common ancestor along the female line. We talked about mitochondrial DNA just last week, by the way. Looking at the results, the researchers noticed that prior to Neolithic farmers, all dogs in Europe shared this genetic lineage, dubbed haplogroup C. After the Neolithic farmers arrived, however, this haplogroup was steadily replaced by a different one called haplogroup D, thus suggesting the introduction of non-indigenous domestic dogs, the researchers write in their study. The dissemination of the D haplogroup across time and space is consistent with the gradual spread of Neolithic farmers from the Middle East. Data shows that Neolithic dogs first emerged in Southeast Europe, then to Central Europe, and eventually reaching Northern and Western Europe, a process that took thousands of years. The Neolithic expansion into Europe took place between 9,000 and 6,000 years ago. Let me drop for a second. That Neolithic farmers would not simply abandon their canine companions as they ventured into Europe makes total sense, both from practical and emotional perspective. The history of our two species is inexorably intertwined. We need dogs as much as they need us, and it has seemingly always been that way. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX. Okay. It's not exactly above the fold of this week's New York Times, but a local Texas-based television station, KWTX, had a curious article published on their website last week. Driving towards Dallas on Interstate 35 East, just past Carl's Corner on the right, there was this unique tower. It had a large circular base, a smaller round structure jutting from the top, and on top of the pole sat a large round metal-looking ball. One of the broadcast engineers at KWTX noticed the thing while coming back from Dallas. He took a picture and brought it to the newsroom so a reporter could figure out what it was. Let me drop for a second. Guesses ranged from some kind of electric-powered car charging port or radar for Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport or Love Field. Maybe something to do with the Internet. Even one guy suggested that it might be a prop for a new Star Trek movie set. Well, more than a few of you out there might see an awfully curious resemblance to Tesla's Wardenclyffe Tower of yore. It turns out to be a high-tech study into the feasibility of transmitting electricity from place to place without wires. Let me drop for a second. It's being undertaken by a Wachoxie company named Viziz, and it uses a technology they call surface wave system, sometimes called Zenik waves. Zenik waves are electromagnetic surface waves, a kind of non-uniform electromagnetic plane wave bound to a spherical boundary interface between two homogeneous media having different dielectric constants. As far as I can research, it is a theoretical solution to Maxwell's equation that goes back more than a century that suggests some very low, non-intuitive planar intensity losses over a given distance. Unfortunately, although this company seems to be selling investors that they have created such waves in a sustainable and controllable manner, their claims remain totally unproven. They are said to be hiding all the exciting stuff until their patents come through. Let me drop for a second. The Viziv surface wave system will improve the quality of life for people everywhere by enabling the delivery of affordable electricity throughout the world, Viziv Technology states on its website. But so far, the company has associated with Baylor Research and Innovation Collaboration on the project, as noted in a recent news release from Baylor that said the research effort in part was to provide the capability to safely, economically, and efficiently deliver electrical power virtually anywhere in the world through the use of surface wave technology. Research within the Baylor Research and Innovation Collaboration will inform each of these applications' commercial development as they continue. Viziv is one of six companies associated with the Baylor Group that's studying similar innovations. The company is headed up by a former USAF Brigadier General, Michael W. Miller, who retired from the Air Force after 28 years of military service. Let me drop for a sec. The company leases 3,000 square feet at Baylor Research and Innovation Collaborative, a 330,000 square foot facility that provides access to fundamental and applied research, industry collaboration, business acceleration and incubation, workforce development, and STEM education, outreach, and research, the Baylor Research and Innovation Collaborative website says. So, if that deal to buy a timeshare of the Brooklyn Bridge has fallen through, or your grandkid won't be needing their college fund because and it's a runoff and become a mine, well, I guess a disinvestment is a touch more prudent than flushing the cash directly down the toilet. At the very least, Nikola Tesla's ghost now haunts Carl's Corner, Texas. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH for the comments?
Yes, VDH.
I think if Tesla's dream of broadcast power ever came true, I think we would find radio unusable. I'm just thinking of the broadband over power line fiasco of a couple of years ago.
Well, I mean, that would be an interesting question, how it would interact with regular RF frequencies. One would assume that perhaps these theoretical planar waves would operate on a lower frequency that might not interrupt. But again, we're sort of talking fairy tales because Nikola Tesla was a genius. He was a brilliant man, but he was a little on the erratic side, and he could drop down his own little rabbit holes, unfortunately. And I think these planar waves, RF waves, that he wanted to encircle the Earth had a lot of problems going for them. But, you know, the dream is still alive, at least in Texas.
WS to land. So at the very end, I'd say like the last 30 seconds, it was starting to break up on you when you were finishing that topic. But it sounded like you were saying that that this is, well, I'm going to paraphrase, that it's really a scam, that they're looking for money and trying to get people to pour money into something that's not possible.
Well, that's my skeptical take on this. It mimics, and again, I already put it on the website. If you go to roy.ac2gs.com, from last week, there's an image of the structure that they took a picture of and a comparison picture of the Wardenclyffe Tower of Nikola Tesla. It sounds a lot like they're trying to reproduce Tesla's failed experiment. And I think there's a good reason why the experiment failed. I tend not to believe the story that it was other shady people who ruined it for Tesla. I think it was just an unfortunate harebrained scheme that couldn't work on a theoretical basis. But yeah, I'm more than a bit skeptical. I think it's a bunch of guys trying to remove investor dollars from investors' wallets into their own.
Oh, okay, I agree. Okay, now I know what you were saying towards the end. Understood. Very good, boy. WS2N.
Okay, I'm sorry for the crashes of noise and such, but not much I can do, unfortunately. I've kind of revved up as much as I can rev up without overheating things. So let's get on to the next somewhat depressing story. Tonight, the Cold War-esque scary bit of cautionary news is plenty scary. It would seem that the government agency had the bright idea to implement an exercise where government-salaried hackers were set loose on our intelligent, very expensive weapon system, just to see what an old Dell laptop might do against the state-of-the-art weapon system. Authorized hackers were quickly able to seize control of weapon systems being acquired by the American military in a test of the Pentagon's digital vulnerabilities, according to a new and blistering government review. Let me drop for a second. A report by the Government Accountability Office concluded that many of the weapons or that control them could be neutralized within hours. The military teams developing or testing the systems were oblivious to the hacking. A public version of the study was published a few weeks ago, deleting all the names and descriptions of which systems were attacked, so the report could be published without tipping off American adversaries. Congress is receiving the classified version of the report, which specifies which among the 1.6 trillion, yes, that's trillion, dollars in weapon systems the Pentagon is acquiring from the defense contractors were affected. Let me drop for a second. But even the declassified review painted a terrifying picture of weakness in the range of emerging weapons, from new generations of missiles and aircraft to prototypes of new delivery systems for nuclear weapons. In one case, the test team took control of the operator's terminal, the report said. They could see in real time what the operators were seeing on their screen and could manipulate the system, a technique reminiscent of what Russian hackers did to a Ukrainian power grid only 2 years ago. The Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of Congress, described red team hackers who were pitted against cyber defenders at the Pentagon. The tested weapons were among a total of 86 weapon systems under development. Many were penetrated either through easy-to-crack passwords or because they had few protections against insiders working on the elements of the program. Let me drop for a second. Sometimes the testing teams toyed with their Pentagon targets. One team reported that there was a pop-up message to appear on a user's terminal instructing them to insert two quarters to continue operating. The steering assessment comes after years of warnings about the vulnerability of the military system, some of which the Government Accountability Office said were ignored. And just as President Trump gives American commanders more flexibility to deploy cyber weapons without obtaining presidential approval, it also suggests that the United States is vulnerable to cyber attacks when it seeks to disable enemy systems. Let me drop for a second. In recent years, the Pentagon has begun to pull intrusion alarms to warn weapon operators of signs of attack. But the Government Accountability Office suggested that those alarms were about as effective as a car alarm going off on the streets of New York, an event so common, everyone assumed it was a false alarm. Intrusion detection systems correctly identified test activities, the report says, but it added the system was already red and warnings were so common that operators were desensitized to them. The congressional auditors called their findings the first time they have examined vulnerabilities of major weapon systems that the federal government is acquiring. Let me drop for a sec. That issue has become more urgent over the past decade. Older weapons used by the Pentagon, some dating to before the Vietnamese War, were minimally dependent on computers or networks, making them naturally resistant to hacking. As the report made clear, and as admirals and generals have been discussing for years, the move to update the system introduces new vulnerabilities. Today's weapon systems are heavily computerized, which opens more attack opportunities for adversaries, the review said. It also found that the increasingly computerized and networked nature of systems was not the only problem. So was the Defense Department's past failure to prioritize weapon system cybersecurity. Let me drop for a sec. Compounding the problem are millions of lines of software that are buried in parts of subsystems, creating vulnerabilities that weapons designers and contractors often do not fully grasp themselves. Weapon systems have a wide variety of interfaces, and some of which of them are not obvious and could be used as pathways for adversaries to access the systems, the study concluded. Similar warnings have been sounded since 2013 when the government's Defense Science Board raised the potential that sophisticated adversaries led by Russia or China could use cyber weapons to neutralize weapon systems even before. In the 5 years since, the Pentagon has been reluctant to discuss the subject beyond vague generalities, insisting that any public hearing of this issue would only invite attacks. Let me drop for a second. Included in the Government Accountability Office's survey of vulnerabilities were submarines, missiles, cargo rockets, radars, fighter jets, refueling tankers, aircraft carriers, destroyers, satellites, helicopters, and electronic jammers. In interviews, office officials said the acquisition program under review included two of the three major classes of nuclear weapons delivery systems, the Columbia-class submarine and the replacement for the nation's aging Minuteman missiles, known as the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent. Nuclear weapons themselves were not included in the report. They are mostly controlled by the Energy Department, which oversees their design and testing. But nuclear weapons have become a focus of increasing scrutiny, both inside and outside the defense establishment. Let me drop for a second. Last month, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a group that studied nuclear threats, published a detailed report about the risk that nuclear weapon systems could be subject to cyber attacks. It warned that such attacks could have a catastrophic consequence, including the risk that weapons could be used in response to false warnings or miscalculations. So, scary stuff, eh? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I guess it didn't scare you enough. Now on to my next story. Just like plastic seemed to be the wonder material of an earlier age, graphene promises to become the solution to so many manufacturing problems. That is why graphene has grasped the material science community's collective imagination. You might wonder why, given all the hype there is, why there isn't graphene in every product you own by now. Well, a new study has found that 60 companies that sell the Nobel Prize-winning ultra-thin carbon sheets produce complete trash. Graphene was supposed to have a revolutionary impact on technology as a whole. But the new study's analysis finds that the international standards for graphene are arbitrary, using what they felt were more accurate definitions of graphene. The researchers found that no commercial company's graphene contains more than 50% actual graphene, and many contained less than 10%. Let me drop for a second.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is this the stuff that was supposed to have low resistance and it was going to make computers faster because of the low resistance? Was that another product I'm thinking of before you go on?
Yeah, this is a downright wonder material. It's going to give us, hopefully, a superconductive room temperature. It's going to give us super capacitors that will be able to effectively produce a charge, a regular battery in seconds. Every week they're issuing new predictions of how graphene is going to revolutionize the world.
Okay, thanks. I just want to make sure what I was thinking about before you continued. So go ahead. Very good for you.
Yeah, Wesley recognized, but let me get to the end of this particular story, and then if you want, we can discuss it or discuss what you want to discuss, okay? Okay, let's see. It's important, if anyone hopes for graphene industry to progress in any meaningful way, according to the paper published in the Journal Advanced Materials, it is worrisome that producers are labeling black powders as graphene and selling it for top dollar, while in reality they contain mostly cheap graphite. This kind of activity gives a bad reputation to the whole industry and has a negative impact on serious developers of graphene applications. Only through standardization and following protocols for characterization can graphene industry evolve reliably, they say. In many cases, the graphene being sold might just be overpriced pencil lead. Scientists Andrei Ghim and Konstantin Novoselov won the 2010 Nobel Prize for isolating and experimenting on graphene in 2004. These single-atom thick sheets of carbon are incredibly strong, and graphene's electric properties might make it useful in screens, phones, solar batteries, solar cells, and everyday technology. The researchers initially isolated the material with scotch tape and pencil lead, but that's available. The company is now just by depositing carbon atoms as a thin film or slicing up graphite and sorting out pieces by their thickness. Let me drop for a second. The newest paper on which Novoselov is a co-author focuses only on the liquid phase exfoliation, the slicing graphite method. The researchers defined graphene as carbon sheets less than 10 atoms thick because if they're sliced thicker, the graphene would lose its useful properties. All of the graphene they analyzed was trash. Their lab analysis from 60 different companies found that all of the supposed graphene actually contains less than 50% graphene content. Part of the companies have less than 10% graphene content, and usually the analyzed fakes had anywhere between 10 and 1,000 layers. And while graphene should be 100% carbon, most of the samples were contaminated. Let me drop for a second. Our extensive studies of graphene production worldwide indicate that there is almost no high-quality graphene as defined by the International Organization for Standardization in the market yet, they wrote. Maybe if material science can find a source for some legitimate graphene, all these seemingly magical new products can get built and used by us impatient consumers. But until bulk graphene manufacturers begin to sell, all we'll get are these interesting preliminary announcements. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
Okay, Anderson.
Yes, Wesley.
So let's start from the beginning to answer your question. Graphene is also of carbon in the form of two-dimensional atomic scale, a honeycomb lattice. Each one atom forms each vertex. And graphene is a mineral from carbon and is naturally present in limestone due to the presence of organic materials. And let me drop. Now, why is not used in mass production? Because it can only grow on metals such as copper or nickel. And that's the problem because the conductive channel graphene needs to be on insulating substrate to be used in conventional electronic devices such as field effect transistor. There are a few other problems. We have a natural crux in it. And they try to synthesize it by oxidizing the bulk graphene using the process known as Hammer method. So the defect generated in the reduction process causes this chemically derived graphene to have inferior electronic properties to pristine graphite. Do you agree with that?
Well, you got to make sure of your terms, because you're calling it graphite, it's not graphite. That's the problem. Graphite is readily available almost every place, including your pencil lead. The problem is the structural problems with graphene, which is a one to ten layers of those two-dimensional sheets of carbon that somehow have to be either peeled away or created out of some other technology without a flaw. So you can't call graphene graphite because that's the problem. Most of the graphene that scientists are using, unfortunately, are adulterated forms of graphite, which is just graphene in large clumps, not fine two-dimensional layers of carbon atoms.
That was unfortunate miswording. It is not that I said graphite. I said graphene. I should say graphene. But other than that, do you agree with that, what I said?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by it's naturally occurring in metallic ores. It's naturally occurring as graphite, as clumps of sheets of graphene on top of each other in nature all over the place, and doesn't really have that much to do with metal ores as well. So it's inexpensive in its graphite multi-molecular version. It's either finding a good manufacturing method to separate the layers, or a manufacturing method of starting from scratch and building low-flawed structures. It's sort of the same problem that we had initially with semiconductors, in which you have to build perfect crystals of silicon to get semiconductors to work. And it took a long time for people to figure out how to grow perfect crystals. So it's a manufacturing problem, but before it's solved, the manufacturers are just foisting contaminated products on researchers, unfortunately.
Should I understand that you agree with that graphite as a mineral from carbon has a graphene in it, naturally occurring?
Okay, graphene is a single atom, two-dimensional network of carbon atoms. If you take a layer of graphene and then put on top of it another layer of graphene, and you do that for 1,000 layers, you effectively have what we also call graphite. Graphite is simply stacked layers of graphene.
Okay, so we agree to that point.
That graphene is made, that graphite is made out of multiple layers of graphene, and it's a naturally occurring mineral. And like I said, the first time they discovered the properties, they were using scotch tape on their lead pencils. That's how they generated the first few of the material.
Okay. So then I was finding on why graphene is not widely used. They grew that part.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the way that I see it, graphene is not used because graphene is very difficult to produce. And so material scientists who are trying to accomplish things and conceive of manufacturing methods of all kinds of fun toys for us all don't have enough useful samples to conduct meaningful experiments. But even once they do, we're still stuck with trying to figure out how to manufacture these things. And chemical manufacture of products have been a problem since the beginning of chemistry and why chemistry really came into existence. Initially, back in the 1800s, it was pigments. They were very expensive. They were naturally occurring. And the first big chemist was in England. The Germans kind of took over the dye industry, but that's the problem. The problem ultimately is the manufacturing a good quality at a cost, at a reasonable cost.
Graphene is synthesized by chemical vapor deposition, exhibits low mobility due to the grain boundaries and cracks by substrate transfer. So graphene grown by the technique can only be grown on metals. And that's why he said that two metals that are being used is copper and nickel. This is a problem because the conductive channel of graphene needs to be on an insulating substrate. And then it could be used in conventional electronic devices. Graphene grown on metal substrates can be transferred to insulating substrates. And when you mentioned the scotch tape, it's right on the point. But the transfer process causes cracks, which degrade the electric or, say, electronic properties of that material. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Wesley. I think I've stated a few times that unfortunately we are at this point with our technology in mass producing or even producing graphene with a significant surface area. The samples that we use are very, very low surface area because of the flaws that get in the way. So it's a production problem. But on top of the production problem, the manufacturers are kind of making believe that the stuff that they're on scientists is legitimate graphene. So the manufacturers have to kind of fess up to these things and work harder in defining what their graphene samples amount to and not voice the cheap pencil lead to people and researchers.
Yes, and one of the ways do that is synthesize the graphene-like material, and they call it reduced graphene oxide that is synthesized by oxidizing bulk graphite using a hammer method. So then it's extrafoliated by the shaking in the water. Then this aqueous dispersion of the graphene oxide can be used to cast films. Then we use that film graphene oxide, as we can reduce the graphene by chemical reducing the agents. We can hydrolyze it thermally. Then we have reduced material that contains a number of defects, and it has also a small amount of oxygen. And to exchange.
Well, Well, that's all well and good, Wesley, but that sounds a lot like liquid phase exfoliation, which was the basis for one of the co-authors writing this report that 60 different companies using that method basically was giving them expensive pencil lead. So although in theory it might prove useful, in practice it doesn't seem to be supplying, and there's no quality control being done by the manufacturers. I think at the very least manufacturers should take responsibility for quality control of these new experimental products, because if you don't hand the researchers the proper materials, you're not going to get much in the way of results.
Yes, I agree with that. Carbon nanotubes and graphene are similar materials, but they are not the same. There is a term being used, CNT, carbon nanotubes, that can be metallic or semiconducting depending on chelarity on the tube. Graphene is a semi-metal. So the synthesis of the carbon nanotubes is also different from the graphene. I don't know enough about carbon nanotubes, so I'm not going to go there.
Okay, very good, Wes. Well, carbon is in the same column as silicon. It's a semiconductor, and true, there are other uses of carbon molecules. There are buckyballs. Organic chemistry is all about carbon and what made us what we are today. And nanotubes made of carbon are very important. And it goes back to one of my other stories this evening about the Vanta Black, the blacker-than-black pigment, 99.965% absorption, is based on carbon nanotubes. And so carbon is ubiquitous. We're made of it, and yet we're finding new things every day about it, which is exciting to me. But I think it's coming up time for the space report, and I want to give Paul a chance. So I just want to remind people that everything that I talked about tonight and then some will be on the website roy.ac2gs.com. And if you have any comments, questions, or topics, please feel free to email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. And thank you very much, Dick, for giving me the this position to have this little talk here.
Nice material. Thank you, Roy. Paul, what's going on in space? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
This is WS2N for the space report for the TechNet. And good news for the Chandra Space Telescope. They got that back in operation. Last week, the week before, I said that Chandra was down. Apparently, the mission control thought that the gyros, the half a dozen gyros on that thing, were one of them failed and went into a safe mode. It was only for a couple of seconds, and because of that couple of seconds that it failed, it went into the safe mode and just shut everything down. It took them a while to straighten things out. It was a 3-second problem. They realized what the problem was, primarily a computer glitch, and it's up and running again, so it still should work. That thing was launched back in 1999, right before the year 2000, and that was a space shuttle, I believe, a Columbia launch, but operating ever since. Detects x-rays, looks at black holes, anything in the x-ray part of the spectrum. Interesting orbit on it as well. It goes about one-third out all the way to the moon and comes back around, I think, around 50,000 miles near the Earth. That's the orbit, and that's the one with it. It doesn't really have a mirror. It's got these long tubes, quarter diameter, glass tubes that run lengthwise. The x-rays would normally go so fast, if it was a mirror, it would go right through it. So it hits these tubes, glazes, off the side of them as it goes down, and then toward the bottom, they they come together. What is it? Detector. That's how our gander works. And, never thought it would last this long. They figured 5 years. Well, it went up in 1999. Not so good for opportunity riding around on Mars. I think it's been riding around 2004 it landed there, January. And it's been operating ever since. But as of last June, that's the last time they heard from it. After it got caught in the worldwide or Mars-wide dust storm that took place for a couple of months. And they could see the spacecraft on the planet. I mentioned that one other time using the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. You have the high-rise camera, it looks down and could actually see the opportunity on the planet. But they still are sending transmissions up, waiting to hear back from it. They think that maybe it has a bunch of sand or dust sitting on the panels. So this is the time of year on Mars. Well, Mars has probably a 2-to-1 ratio compared to Earth, but this is the time for Mars when they have a lot of dust storms or wind that goes by, without the big global dust storm that they had, but a lot of wind. And it's happened before many times where the wind will actually blow the dust off the solar panels. That's what they're hoping for, and then they can get it back into operation. Solar panels only get around 400 or 500 watts. Right now it's probably down to zero. If they do ever get enough sunlight on there and start to charge a battery, the computer would eventually come on and it would start searching for a signal from Earth, trying to get an idea of what time of day it is and what day it is, eventually they can set the clock, and once they hear from it, might do okay. They have a couple of more months that NASA is giving the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to contact Opportunity. Hope it works out, because just build another one and send it up, put it into that same location, and it would probably cost $500 million. So it's why it's a lot less expensive to pay some operators here on Earth to try to make contact with it. So, that's the story on that. On a sadder note, anybody who knows of Paul Allen, of Microsoft fame, him and Bill Gates started that company, has passed away. But he had gotten away from Microsoft back in the 80s because he knew he had some kind of a sickness, and which eventually wound up killing him. He took his billions of dollars from the 1980s and invested it, among other things, in the space program. And he got involved with the Paul Allen Array, which, again, how many antennas that are pointing to space looking for intelligent life. But I think over the years he's turned that over to a college, I believe, that handles that operation now, for the Paul Allen Array. So far he hasn't contacted ET, but he's giving it a shot. Spent a lot of money on that system. But his other investments were actually paid off. He's gotten involved with Bert McCann of Voyager fame. That developed the Voyager, not spacecraft, but airplane that flew around the Earth. The two people without refueling. So that's what he did back in the early 80s. Barbara Tan went on to designing spacecraft. His goal was to spacecraft that could take off on wheels on the ground, go to space, and come back and land with wheels on the ground. So he developed they call it Spaceship One. and with the help of Paul Allen, poured a lot of money into this, and eventually it was successful, and I believe the pilot got the credit for getting the the Google Prize. It was called something else. Think of it, got one an A, but millions of dollars